Good evening, everybody. I'm Charles Berry, the chairman of the board of the New York Society Library, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this terrific event. The New York City Book Awards is one of our most important events. It's wonderful to be able to celebrate the diversity of the city in the awards that we do. I'd like to make a particular welcome to Susan Henshaw Jones, the president of the Museum of the City of New York, who has brought great vitality to that institution, fellow institution. And I'd also like to thank Roger Pasquier, the chair of our awards committee, and all the members of the committee who put such great work into all of this. I'd like to remind all of you that the books are available for sale and for autographing by the authors. And without more ado, I'll hand it over to Roger. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'll add my thanks to all of you who have come. And just to note that here on these tables and over the mantle are some, or I think all of the previous winners that we have given prizes to over the last 16 years. So for the authors and for others of you, let me tell you a little bit about the process, because as I've said to some of the authors, this is much more fun than a book club because we can fight about the books. Every year, an astounding number of books are published about New York City. This year, more than 150 that we looked at. And we're always looking for books that give insight into one or another aspect of New York, past or present, and that would be enjoyed by our library members. And our jury expertise helps us separate the authoritative and the original from the things that are merely derivative and error-filled. Every book is read by at least one juror, and as we narrow the field, we want more and more jurors to read the promising work so that the winners have all been read by everybody on the jury, and we have achieved a consensus. So the jury members are all listed inside your program, and perhaps you've read some of our books, because every member except one this year is a published author, and all of us are active in one or another aspect of New York's literary world as authors, editors, journalists, and publishers. And just to give you a sense of the variety of topics that we have written on, some of which are about New York. People have written from our jury on books about New York in different eras, the art market and collecting, New York politics, German literature, ornithology and conservation, architecture, urban planning, several different sports, biography, corporate behavior, social science, museums and cultural trends, New York artists and art spaces, and fiction. And this year's winners testified to the diversity of the topics and diversity and specialization of the topics that we review and have found outstanding. And we're very lucky this year to have Susan Henshaw Jones give us her perspective on these books and writing about New York. She tells me she has been the president and director of the Museum of the City of New York since 2002. She tells me that her roots are in four of the city boroughs. But she added that, I am extrapolating that her, in fact, acute observational capacity that comes only from being an outsider comes from her having grown up in New Jersey. So, but her first job was here in New York in Mayor Lindsay's Office of Lower Manhattan Development. For many years, she was the director and then the president of the New York City Landmarks Conservancy. She went to Washington to raise the cultural level there and was president of the National Building Museum. And as I say, since 2002, she's been running the Museum of the City of New York. And if you have been there, or if you had been there in the last century, you would know what a difference that Susan has made there. So Susan, thank you very much for coming to us, slightly senior organization. I should add that Susan and her husband are also members of this library. So we're delighted to have you, and take it away. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Yes, my husband, Richard Eaton, is in the back there, and he comes most every Saturday to the library, and he always comes back amazed that he's found the book that he's looking for again and again and again. He loves it. But I thank you all for inviting me to be part of these award presentations, and above all, I thank you for making me read these books. Three wonderful books. 2 Cents Plain, My Brooklyn Boyhood by native New Yorker Martin Lemelman. Rochdale Village, Robert Moses' 6,000 Families and New York City's Great Experiment in Integrated Housing by Peter Eisenstadt. And Harlem, A Century in Images, a selection of photography by Thelma Golden, who is the director and chief curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem. I am the president, but I'm also the Rone Menchel director of the Museum of the City of New York. And I think that many of you knew Louis Auchincloss, who was beloved to both the society and to the museum, where Louis served as the head of the board for about 30 years. Over the past 8 years, it's been just very, very rewarding for me, and I hope for our visitors, as we delve into the city's past, and to me, of even greater interest is delving into the recent past. Now, it just turns out that there are many connections between the three books and the museum's exhibitions, so interestingly, the stories blend and merge, and the narrative that I begin now really comes from all of these sources. Rochdale Village was a creation of Robert Moses and Abraham Kazan of the United Housing Foundation. They were two giants in 20th century New York City history. At the museum in the recent past, both giants have been the subject of exhibitions. Moses was revisited in an exhibition called Robert Moses and the Modern City, Remaking the Metropolis. It was one of three related exhibitions and a book that looked anew at the legacy of Robert Moses. It was the thesis of historian Hillary Ballen, who is now Deputy Vice Chancellor for Academic Programs for NYU, that Moses' very real contributions to New York City and the region had been overlooked, buried by an admirable but highly critical, even damning, biography by Robert Caro. Robert Moses was very big on recreation, and his roadways led to parklands and beaches on Long Island, and later, when he was New York City Parks Commissioner in Queens. And his parkways and his 14 bridges alleviated traveling in and out of the city. Think of traveling over the George Washington Bridge right into the grid of Washington Heights. It would take a long, long time to get downtown. But it was said that Moses was a racist, allowing MetLife in the leasing of Stuyvesant Village to exclude blacks. It was asserted that the design of roadways leading to beaches excluded blacks by making the roads to these beaches only for cars and not for buses, and the buses could not fit under the overpasses. Moses actively and diligently worked to create the initially integrated Rochdale. He got the land, he got the support of the state and the financing, he made the deal with the United Housing Foundation, which only put up $10 million, and they were all down payments from tenants out of a cost of $86 million. And when Rochdale opened, it was 20% African American and 80% white. And the overwhelming majority of these whites were Jewish. And remember, these were cooperators who opted to live there. They invested their money. They were working class people. They invested their money to move to South Jamaica. It was uncoerced integration. And that's what Peter Eisenstadt said. This is, I'm paraphrasing from his book. If many share in the credit for the creation of Rochdale, its prime mover was Moses. Its existence is a tribute to his powers of persuasion and his dogged persistence. Eisenstadt makes clear that Moses was a builder first and foremost, for whom slum clearance and urban renewal were not dirty words. And they were not dirty words to Abraham Kazan. Now, am I saying that correctly? Is it Kazan? How do we say it? Kazan. Thank you. Okay. Kazan was an unschooled Jewish immigrant and the great pioneer of the nonprofit housing nonprofit cooperative housing movement here in the city. He saw appalling tenement conditions in the city in the first half of the 20th century, leading him to create the United Housing Foundation, which sought to provide affordable housing for working class people in which residents owned their apartments. They were called limited equity co-ops. People could live there, but when they died or moved out, they had to sell the unit back to the corporation. And thus the term limited equity, because the value of the apartment was not its market value. Moses, at the end of his career, believed, according to Eisenstadt, that cooperation was the only way to provide middle-income housing in the city. Now, Abraham Kazan had a utopian view of cooperation. He believed that the conditions in which people lived could foster collective identity and action. He believed that people needed light and air in every room, that they needed open space, that they needed recreational and educational facilities, and all of these things were required to create community. And they needed services at acceptable costs. His dream included cooperative stores that offered lower prices because they were not run for a profit. And in Rochdale Village, because he'd had a run-in with Con Ed, even its own power plant. So thus, on 120 acres that Moses got, Rochdale Village included 5,860 residential units, which had multiple bedrooms, in 20 separate towers, and the development included two public schools, a police station, a library, two malls, and, as I said, its own power station. There's one person here that I can't go on without recognizing, and his name is Cal Jones. And Cal is my partner at the Museum of the City of New York. He was the Manhattan historian, the borough historian for Manhattan. And Cal, in fact, was one of the original cooperators in Rochdale Village. And he's here with his daughter, who grew up in part there. So that so that's really wonderful. Cal did move back into Manhattan. And that's good because he volunteers at the Museum of the City of New York, so it has to be close to home. But I'm so delighted that Cal is here this evening. And if you read this book, this tremendous book, Cal is quoted throughout. Now, limited equity co-ops were an outgrowth in the main of the labor movement. And today, it is estimated that well over 100,000 New Yorkers live in limited equity units in the five boroughs. This thing did not go away. Everybody knows about Co-op City, where there are 40,000 people living in Co-op City. And in fact, Co-op City cratered the future of the movement because the cooperators forgot that they were owners and they acted like tenants, withholding rent and even more. Penn South in Manhattan, I think everybody knows about that. Now, at the Museum of the City of New York, around 5 years ago, we organized an exhibition called Radicals in the Bronx, and it was about four limited equity cooperatives in the Bronx that were created starting in 1925 by different political factions or differently denominated, predominantly Jewish labor activists. And young Abraham Kazin was an actor in the creation of amalgamated housing in the Bronx. Integration was sought in the creation of amalgamated housing and in all of these cooperatives. And it was achieved, although the number of African Americans was small. And the nonprofit cooperative housing market, I should note, flourished again after World War II. That, of course, is when Rochdale Village was constructed. Now, one point I would like to make about the architecture of these developments that's dealt with so wonderfully in Eisenstadt's book, which is the concept of a tower placed in the middle of a site surrounded by greenery. And this then, in the early part of the 20th century, earlier part of the 20th century, was regarded as a new social and architectural ideal. The concept did fall completely out of favor. I mean, now we associate the setting and the form with public housing projects, but the initial impetus in terms of the design of these projects was, in fact, that they were an ideal. And we have to remember that. And they do now provide wonderful open space in New York. And at the Museum of the City of New York, right behind us, we have the largest public housing development in the city, and I walk through it every day, and I see birds, and so I think it's terrific. So urban visions, it's very interesting how these things compete. And in Eisenstadt's book, he contrasts the urban vision of Jane Jacobs and Abraham Kazin in a tremendously interesting way. Now, Eisenstadt's book tells a very sad story in so many ways of the reality of the times rupturing in this place, the commitment to integrated living that was part of the legacy of these co-ops. But this doesn't negate all the wins. All the lives throughout the entire history of these limited equity co-ops that were changed by living in an integrated setting. Now, I have to say that Eisenstadt's book is a triumph of local history. It is so richly researched. I couldn't believe all the stories in the New York Times on this development. Now the Times carries no local news. I don't know where you'd go today, Peter, to find all of this information. It is beautifully written. It is sympathetic to all of the players in the drama that he relates. It passes no judgments. It must have taken a simply enormous amount of time to do. It is an immensely important undertaking. So I can't tell you how moved I was by this great book. Martin Lemelman's book is a moving graphic memoir. He is a gifted artist, and it tells a story about Jewish immigrants of a later day than the Jewish labor activists who populated Rochdale. Lemelman's father was a Holocaust survivor who didn't arrive in New York until 1947. His family first ran a candy store on the Lower East Side, where Lemelman remembers Yiddish as the language of the street, and just as it is today in parts of Brooklyn, before they bought a chicken and dairy farm in Sullivan County, New York, in the early 1950s. I just love this, that they went off to where my husband's from. So returning to New York City and growing up in Brownsville in Brooklyn, Lemelman watched his neighborhood change as Latinos and African Americans moved in. There is a quote in the book by Malcolm X: "The Jews have been located in the so-called community, Negro community, as merchants and businessmen for so long that they feel guilty when you mention that the exploiters of Negroes are Jews." But, you know, we face this very same face a paradox. These are the very same people who, in the beginning part of the early of the 20th century and longer, sought integration in the Bronx, later in Queens at Rochdale, and in Brownsville. Lemelman's family and other families moved out as crime took over the streets. Meanwhile, up in Harlem, the Great Migration started altering the character of the streets of Harlem in the early part of the 20th century as tens of thousands of African Americans fled the South. An exhibition, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, How the Apollo Theater Changed, Shaped American Entertainment, just closed at the museum on Sunday. And it documented this storied venue, a center of African American culture for decades. The Apollo figures prominently in the wonderful selection of photographs assembled by Thelma Golden, whose grandparents grew up in Harlem, but his father grew up in Queens. So we have to find out if she was from South Jamaica. That's right adjacent to Rochdale. Very interestingly, the Apollo was owned and run by Jewish entrepreneurs throughout the time of the venue's greatest fame, when it introduced Diana Ross, Smokey Robinson, Dionne Warwick, James Brown, and many more. And those individuals were the first crossover artists, African-American performing artists who were lionized and whose records were bought by white audiences, white teenagers, me. Now, the exhibition included these little small index notes indicating how much people were paid. It's amazing. On the Fats Domino card, it says that he performed with a six-man band and they paid him $10,000, and then in red type it said overpaid. Now Harlem, as evidenced in this wonderful selection of images, is almost a state of mind. It is, and I quote from Carol Willis's essay, a separate, self-contained culture, a culture rich in its own heritage. The Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s was a flowering of literature, art, photography, and music. It was followed by the Great Depression, but the nightclubs were hot. The Cotton Club had a whites-only policy, and Cornell Kappa captured the 1930s Harlem innovation, the Lindy Hop. And these are these most intensely alive black and white images from 1939. This is really a wonderful collection of photography. The politics of Harlem, the struggle for civil rights, are just as vivid. Adam Clayton Powell, the first black person to serve on the New York City Council in 1941, was elected to the Congress in 1944. And in 1963, there's a photograph of him in the book, introducing John F. Kennedy in front of the in front of the hotel, the Teresa Hotel, and Kennedy is flanked by Eleanor Roosevelt. An image of Joseph Baker is Josephine Baker is there. She was performing in Harlem in 1950, but in 1951 she was refused entry to the Stork Club. So much happened in such a short period of time. That Harlem is considered over an entire century, and the most astonishing thing is how many of the buildings remain the same. Harlem was first home to the Dutch in the 17th century, then to the Italians, Irish, and Jews in the 19th century. In 1910, Elizabeth Alexander noted in her essay that blacks were about 10% of Central Harlem's population. By 1930, they were a 70% majority. The African American population peaked at 98 in 1950, and by 2008, this population had gone down to 62%. And somebody told me now that they've seen statistics that it's even. One of the implicit threads, and something that I believe is one of New York's greatest strengths, is that we are a city of immigrants. And we live cheek by jowl. And we frequently clash. And we live in pockets that are always, that are in flux. Change is our byword. Rochdale Village is probably changing yet again with a new set of immigrants seeking affordable housing. And with Brownsville and Williamsburg now reborn with young people and artists. New York's bywords, and those of the Museum of the City of New York, are diversity, opportunity, perpetual transformation, and I would like to add, in spite of all of the injustices that are part of each of these books, tolerance. Thank you very, very much. Now, the first award is actually for Thelma Golden, and she is not here, but in her stead are Lauren Hayes and Liz Gwynn. Yes? Hi. Tell Thelma I thought it was just a wonderful, wonderful book of photography. Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
So I'm Elizabeth Gwynn. I'm the Communications and Publications Manager at the Studio Museum in Harlem, and I, along with Lauren Haynes, our assistant curator, had the privilege to coordinate this amazing and collaborative project that is Harlem: A Century in Images under the leadership of the Studio Museum's director and chief curator, Thelma Golden. On behalf of Thelma and the entire team who worked on and contributed to this book, I would like to thank the New York Society Library for this tremendous honor. The Harlem Book, as we're still in the habit of calling it, was the museum's very first publication not directly tied to our collection or exhibitions, though it is very much tied to our mission, and we learned so much throughout the process of making this volume. We experienced and explored over 100 years of Harlem history and culture through the eyes of the many talented photographers included in this book, as well as the many, many more whose work we researched and considered along the way. We are very proud of this volume and thrilled at the contribution it has made to a rich understanding of the vibrant and historic neighborhood we know and love. We are truly moved by this recognition and hope you all find the book as inspiring as we have. Thank you.
And Martin Lemelman, you know, and I didn't get a chance to say hello to you earlier. But I have to say that Martin lives in Allentown, Pennsylvania. So that the dairy and the chicken farm,
right,
it's back.
All the factories are closed.
Okay, thank you. I have a couple of things to say here. I want to thank you, Susan, and thank the Society for this wonderful honor, and it's kind of like the Academy Awards, I think. I'd like to thank my mother and my father, may they rest in peace, for giving me life in a Brooklyn boyhood. I'm grateful to my brother, Bernard, for standing by me all these years ago. Those years ago, he thought I was a genius when all I was a little kid creating art on cheap typewriter paper. I want to thank Rob McQuilkin for having faith in me in the book. Guaranteed you couldn't find a better person or agent. Thanks also goes to Kathy Belden, my editor at Bloomsbury USA. And above all, I want to thank my dear wife, Monica. Although I yell at you when you suggest something, you're usually right. So it's official. It's funny how opportunities present themselves. They show up and just knock you on the head. In 1989, I was pretty happy illustrating children's books. I was drawing boys with cold noses, girls on farms, kids with hat fetishes. Then out of the clear blue, along came this frozen chicken, and children's books faded from my life. My career as a graphic memoirist began. One Friday, all those years ago, my mother called me. Oy, Matala, I'm not doing so good. I wanted to make a chicken for Shabbos, for the Sabbath, and it fell on my foot. A frozen chicken can give you such a clup. It hurts, but I'm okay. When I told my wife about this conversation, she read me the Riot Act, and she said, "You're going to pick up your mother now." And she was in Far Rockaway, and I was in Allentown. And in no time, I was on the road. Sure enough, she had a broken foot and was ordered by our doctor to stay off of it for 6 weeks. There are easy instructions for anyone and everyone except my mother. Before, when she visited our house, she delighted in cleaning the floors and washing the dishes and changing diapers and cooking. She'd stand for 2 hours frying onions for homemade Veronicas. I just learned recently that's called caramelizing from the Food Channel. I didn't know that until now. This broken foot visit was no different. I couldn't keep her in a chair. Sad to say, I wound up yelling at her to sit down, but that really was not much of a solution. A, it made me feel awful to yell at a Holocaust survivor mom, and B, she didn't listen to me. After racking my brains, I came up with a solution. I figured this would be the perfect time for her to tell me about her life before the war and her survival hiding in a Polish forest. Up until that point, she never spoke about it. "Fet," she said, "who needs to know such a thing? Better it's forgotten." After much prodding, she was convinced. I sat her in front, sat her down at our kitchen table, and she began to speak. Out came her life. Her story wandered, curved around itself. She went from 1933 to 1956 and back again to 1943. I heard about her little town in Poland, her family, Eisenhower, my father, the Polish forest, our Brooklyn candy store, what rotten kids my brother and I were. It was the powerful jumbled tale of one woman's life. It was the story of my mother, Gusta Lemelman. Years later, I created my first graphic memoir, Mendel's Daughter, her story in her voice. When this first book was done, I felt compelled to continue our family's story, but decided it would be my story in my voice. This new book, 2 Cents Plain, is my tale of growing up in Brooklyn with egg creams, comic books, toys, and immigrant parents. Visit my old neighborhood now, and you'll see nothing much that is left of the Brownsville of the 1950s and 60s. Today, there's a townhouse where my father's store, Teddy's Candy Store, used to be. The 3 back rooms crammed with cardboard boxes filled with merchandise, the place where my brother and I grew up, are gone. But as luck would have it, there are objects that survived. My mother saved report cards, bills, photographs, receipts, certificates, everything. And through these artifacts, I touched my memories. 2 Cents Plain became my attempt to recreate my childhood through these words, through words, hundreds of my drawings, and my mother's saved artifacts. It is a virtual scrapbook of my life. But a book takes a life of its own, and as I was working on 2 Cents Plain, it also became the account of a Brownsville in transition, of people buffeted by history. It became the story of a community of Holocaust survivors, the deli man, the fish man, the peddler, these good people attempting to begin a new life for themselves in their golden Medina, the golden land, America. 2 Cents Plain tracks their neighborhood as the 50s, a time of renewal and growth, turns into the 1960s, a time of rising racial tension and increasing violence. There is a Yiddish saying that Gott hat sich beschaffen a Welt mit kleiner Weltelach. God created a world filled with little worlds. 2 Cents Plain is my attempt at reconstructing the world of my Brooklyn, a world that no longer exists. Thank you.
That was really wonderful. And Peter Eisenstadt, will you come up here?
Thank you, Susan, and thank everybody for coming. I was truly humbled by the utterly unexpected news that the New York Society Library had awarded my book, Rochdale Village, the award for the best book on New York City history, published in 2010. I would like to thank the Society as profoundly as I can for this signal honor, and my only regret is not called the New York Academy Library so I could thank the Academy. There are many, many others to thank. First and foremost, my wonderful, beautiful wife, who has walked with me down this and so many other paths, Dr. Jane DeLuca. And second, the next month, I would like to thank Cornell University Press for believing in this project and seeing it through from a gleam in my eye to a bouncing baby book. Working with Michael McGandy, with Jonathan Zimmerman and Brian Bello, the series editors, and the rest of the staff at Cornell has been a pleasure from beginning to end. I think it is customary on such occasions to mention the number of presses, including several well-regarded academic presses headquartered in the city, who passed on this book without so much of the fare thee well, but such petty score-settling is entirely beneath me. The writing of any book is a journey, and this journey began for me as long ago as September 1964, when I was 10, and when me and my family moved into a brand new apartment in Rochdale Village, at the time the largest housing cooperative of the world. We lived in Rochdale until 1973, and when we moved on and moved out, I must say I didn't give Rochdale Village too much thought until around 2002, when I was contacted by my old sixth grade classmate, Barbara Brandy Roth, who had started a chat room for old Rochdale residents. After a few months of reacquainting myself with old friends and making new ones, I decided the history of Rochdale was a unique story, one that needed to be, and one that I very much wanted to tell. Unlike the book by my worthy co-recipient, Marty Lemelman, Rochdale Village is not a memoir, but it is everywhere suffused by my memories of growing up in a place that was utterly as extraordinary and as completely ordinary as Rochdale Village. I would like to thank the Society Library and its distinguished panel for awarding a book about a place in New York City that most New Yorkers have never heard of and whose action takes place almost entirely in the sorely neglected borough of Queens. As far as I can tell, looking over the previous list of recipients of New York Society Library Prizes, the only previous time the borough of Queens has been so recognized when it gave an award to Vincent Seyfried, my old buddy from the first edition of the Encyclopedia of New York City, and perhaps the finest local historian of New York City of his generation. Queens is, as the historian and Queens native William Luckenberg once noted, a place of over 2 million people without a history, or at least without a history that standard narratives of American history deign to take any notice of. Every part of New York City has its own history and deserves its own historians. And once we get past the bedazzlement of Manhattan, the enchantments of Brooklyn, and the Sturm und Drang of the Bronx, there still is a lot of city left. And while I'm promoting Queens, let me add, and please don't laugh, I hope one day soon a historian of Staten Island will win a New York Society Library Prize. As a wise person once told me, there are no dull places, only dull historians. Susan mentioned some of the history of Rochdale, and my book is an attempt to use Rochdale to tell the story of race relations in New York City in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and how Rochdale was a model for integration when it opened and how this collapsed in the early 70s. Rochdale is still a flourishing limited equity cooperative, but it is no longer integrated. This is the trajectory I try to tell, the story I try to tell in my book. I try to tell a story without heroes and villains, but a history of basically decent people on all sides trying to improvise remedies to extraordinary difficult problems without easier evidence solutions. One of the non-villains in my book, as Susan mentioned, is Robert Moses, who along with Abraham Kazin was one of the two main creators of Rochdale. Moses overcame most opposition, including deep-seated skepticism on the part of many bankers, union leaders, and politicians as to whether a moderate income, racially mixed cooperative in a black neighborhood had any chance of survival. And one of the non-heroes in my book is Jane Jacobs, who I deeply admire but was simply wrong in her blanket dismissal of all high-rise super-block housing as anti-urban blights on the city's landscape. One of the purposes of my book is to offer a defense of high-rise super-block urbanism. Rochdale residents enjoyed a rich, densely entwined urban experience equal to that available anywhere in the city, contrary to Jacobs and her generation of high-rise hating epigenies. At the heart of the book is the saga of integration in Rochdale. Rochdale was the largest experiment in integrated housing and education in New York in the 1960s, if not the largest such experiment at the time in the entire United States. The common consensus, ratified by the predominant historical opinion, is that integration, that is, serious efforts at interracial housing and education, were doomed from the outset by the naivete and cluelessness as to the depths of America's racial tension. Ever since, those on right, left, and center have used different arguments to arrive at the same conclusions. Whites and blacks are simply too different for integration to be more than a pipe dream smoked by liberal do-gooders. And the pathetic lack of integration, for the most part, in this country over the past half century, towards realizing this goal would seem to offer abundant confirmation and corroboration for integration skeptics. For me, to borrow a phrase from C. Van Woodward, integration in the 1960s in Rochdale and elsewhere was another of the many forgotten alternatives in America's long, gnarled racial history. Like Woodward's Reconstruction, another time of intense black-white collaboration, integration in the 1960s was a failure. But we can learn much from our failures, perhaps especially not to be quite so complacent about their inevitability. Just this morning, I was reading a review of a new biography of Stanley N. Durham, the peripatetic anthropologist and presidential mother. And commenting on her life, President Obama said his mother taught him that beneath our services were all the same, and the naivete and idealism that was a part of her is naive idealism in him. I think it's hard to write about things like Rochdale without using terms like naive, and I think maybe it makes us all a little embarrassed. A glimpse in the history of Rochdale, for both blacks and whites, it was a hard-as-nailed, utterly pragmatic optimism with nothing dreamy about it. Integration in Rochdale was based on the proposition that people from different races are fundamentally similar despite superficial differences. At the time and ever since, it has been all too easy to fall in the opposite belief, that people from different races are fundamentally different with only superficial similarities. What President Obama called naive idealism is perhaps what another president once called the better angels of our nature. The final point I want to make about Rochdale became increasingly important as I was finishing the book. Rochdale was a product of an era when all of New York City's most important leaders, Mayor Wagner, Governor Rockefeller, and Robert Moses, were committed to building affordable housing as a major public priority. The intellectual and political climate that created Rochdale Village and bolstered the social democratic vision of the United Housing Foundation that built Rochdale Co-op City and many other limited equity cooperatives from the 50s on simply dissolved and melted in the acid of the fiscal crisis in the mid-70s. it has not returned. In its place, we've had several generations of marketplace solutions to our housing problems, accompanied by a vertiginous rise in housing prices, and a variety of hucksters, including a recent huckster-in-chief in the White House, overselling and over-touting the virtues of ownership society, in which the goal of every self-respecting family was to own a piece of property. And when all of this came tumbling down, as these things always do, in 2007, 2008, to the tune of $4 or $5 trillion in lost capital, it was in many cases minority homeowners who were left holding the bag. It's a considerable irony that in South Jamaica, in the neighborhood around Rochdale, has one of the highest rates of mortgage foreclosure in the nation, while the waiting list to move into Rochdale just grows and grows. A governmental commitment to affordable housing has become, I am afraid, yet another forgotten alternative in urban policy. I would like to think we have learned our lesson, and perhaps my book can make a small contribution in this area, but I am sort of skeptical. Let me get off the soapbox. I really don't want to give the impression that Rochdale Village is thesis-driven or a catalog of grievances. At least I hope it isn't. It is, above all, a gathering of stories, my stories, and the stories of many people who helped create Rochdale and live there, collected from 50 oral histories and lots of other evidence of how their lives were entwined in creating and fashioning a community. I spoke to family members, old friends, acquaintances, former teachers, and a whole host of remarkable people. They crossed the political spectrum from a close associate of Malcolm X. Malcolm X, by the way, visited Rochdale. To the widow of Meir Kahan, the far right-wing rabbi who lived in Rochdale. And I enjoyed speaking to everybody I spoke to, whatever their politics were, and I tried to tell their story as much as I could from their perspective. What was so special about writing this book, it gave me a chance to revisit my childhood and to understand, with the eyes and historical sophistication of an adult, the social forces that were shaping my life and which we in Rochdale, in our own small way, helped to shape. Writing this book was a tremendous privilege, and the award from the New York Society Library is a sign that I might in some small part succeed in my goal, using Rochdale in its ordinariness and extraordinariness as a portal from which to enter the larger history of New York City's fraught encounter with race in the 1960s and 70s. I would like to thank the many, many people who assisted me in the writing of this book, and the friends and family who sustained me in the writing it, some of whom are present tonight, and I thank all the members of my entourage. And let me just take a moment to remember one person missing tonight, my late brother Freddie. Had he lived to see this day, he would have been my loudest applauder. And finally, and once again, let me thank the New York Society Library for the honor they have bestowed on me, one that I will never forget, and thank you all for coming.
That was great. Yeah. Roger?
Thank you all very much. Mark, our librarian, you have a few words to add.
I won't be long. Thank you all for coming and being patient. We have wine, drinks, much left, so please stay. I did actually want to say one thing, which was to thank the publishers of these books again, Bloomsbury USA for 2 cents plain, the Studio Museum of Harlem's Gary Rizzoli for Harlem, and of course for Rochdale Village, Cornell University Press. I think it's really important to acknowledge that good publishing companies are out there publishing good books in print, bound with paper. And this, of course, is a library that does love to celebrate the printed book. Thank you all for coming, and thanks Susan Henshaw-Jones for hosting tonight. Thank you.